Today's episode is brought to you by the E-Commerce Fuel private community for seven and eight-figure owners. We have an amazing, vibrant forum where you can connect and get answers to your questions, but probably one of the biggest long-term values is our events, where you can build deep connections with other owners. We have ECF Live, our annual summit, where all of our members and attendees are vetted versus, you know, a lot of e-commerce events where you have zillions of people trying to sell you stuff. We have adventures, great talks, curated dinners. Ecom Camp, which is our annual event for eight-figure store owners and smaller meetups and dinners throughout the year. So if you're looking to connect with people just like you, people in e-commerce, obsessed with their business, who can talk about it for hours, our community is the place to do it. So that sounds interesting. You can find out more information and apply at ecommercefuel.com. Did you know that e-commerce stores are losing 10 to 15% of their revenue by not offering upsells? It's true, but you can get that money back instantly with the OneClick Upsell app. OneClick Upsell is already the number one upsell app for over 18,000 Shopify stores, including Tushy, Dr. Squash, Buffy, and Victoria Beckham. And it's made hardworking entrepreneurs like you $670 million in extra upsell revenue. All it takes is a few clicks, and you can add pre-purchase, post-purchase upsells, and cross-sells to every product on your store. In fact, the average user boosts their total sales by 10 to 15% as soon as they set it up. It's super easy to get started. Install the app, launch your first upsell funnel, and start making 10 to 15% more sales in less than 10 minutes. So if you like free money, go to oneclickupsell.com after the episode to start your free 30-day trial. Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure e-commerce brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And today, very excited to have Charlie Guo on the podcast, who is ECF member at large. He is the owner of crowdmade.com, which is an e-commerce business, and also the author of Artificial Ignorance. I love the name, like I told you earlier, which is an AI newsletter. And man, Charlie, I've been wanting to have you on for a little while, partially because you've been a great member. It seems like you're doing some interesting things, but you are very deep in the AI world. And a lot of, I mean, obviously AI has been a hot topic for a year now, but few people, I think, are covering it as consistently and as deeply as you are. So excited to jump in and talk about a bunch of stuff. But great to have you here. And thanks for being a part of the community. It's been fantastic having you.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and appreciate the kind words. You know, it's been a interesting journey so far. I think both running an e-commerce business and writing a newsletter, but we'll get into that.
Yeah, and I'm going to date this. I usually don't do this for podcasts, but we're recording February 23rd. But man, with how fast things change in this space, even with prioritizing this to get this out in within a couple of weeks, there'll still be some things that are maybe a little bit stale. But I feel like we're doing this on a pretty good week because there's been so much that happened. And maybe we could just to set one thing that I was looking at yesterday that just made my head explode was NVIDIA's market cap is now larger than Amazon and Alphabet. Like I knew they were big. I knew that they were growing and they were doing well. I had no idea that they were getting, that they're, is it the third biggest company by market cap in the United States, which is just, it boggled my mind seeing that.
I think it was yesterday or maybe Wednesday on the back of their Q4 earnings release, they picked up the single biggest gain in Wall Street history. It was, I think, $220 something billion, which is just bonkers.
Yeah, it's just insanity. It kind of just speaks to how fast they're growing. Do you, for people who don't know, my knowledge of NVIDIA is used to be like back in college, if you had an NVIDIA graphics card, it was awesome, right? Like the, you know, graphics processing units, they've moved into a lot of AI chips now. And so I know that, you know, they're making chips designed and specifically for AI. But apart from that, I don't know a lot about their business model or their growth. Anything, I think a lot of people listening are probably in that same boat. They kind of are aware they're in the AI space, but that's about it. What can you give people kind of maybe the lay of the land on like why they've grown so quickly, why they're so valuable, how they just, you know, shotgunned or slingshotted up to the third biggest company in the US in a matter of 18 months? Like tell people a little bit more about that company, what's making them so valuable or the markets make them think it's so valuable.
Yeah. I mean, their recent valuation aside, I think they've had kind of an incredible run for the last, I would say the better part of a decade at least. The recent AI spike, you know, has really taken us to the next level. But even before then, they actually experienced a lot of growth on the back of crypto. They, you know, they got caught up in the crypto wave. There was, I remember when you couldn't get your hands on a 4090, right? Not a brand new one anyway. You know, they were being scalped like Taylor Swift tickets for just 5x the retail value.
And this is because people were using their cards to mine crypto as like Bitcoin miners, right?
Yeah, yeah. I went down, this is a very wild tangent, but I went down this rabbit hole with some friends. We actually managed to get our hands on about 300 below market rate GPUs, and we sold 150 of them just to like make our money back. And then we took the other 150 and we built these like dining table sized Ethereum mining rigs and learned an insane amount about like, I mean, just what goes into actually trying to mine cryptocurrency. Learned a lot about the inner workings of cryptocurrency itself, which is perhaps another discussion. But I'm not, you know, I've never been kind of a true believer necessarily in that sort of stuff. And yeah, and I think the NVIDIA chips were, you know, AMD and NVIDIA at the time were kind of really the prize chips. But you know, the crypto boom kind of died out and it was unclear what was going to happen to NVIDIA's growth. And then they ended up like, you, I mean, it's a combination of, I think, like luck and preparation, right? You know, that's the old saying, luck is opportunity meets preparation. They had for years really invested in not just the hardware to power AI applications, but the software. So when it comes to building, you know, at the lowest level, you're building these programs to run across GPUs. They had invested for a long time in making that software a good experience to work with, like at least, you know, far easier than AMD or Intel. And I think as a result, you know, the AI community for years and, you know, these deep learning projects and models, they've existed for far longer than ChatGPT, right? And so they have slowly been kind of building a pretty big moat in the machine learning community when it comes to both the hardware and the software stack. And then now that the world has kind of gone a little bit AI crazy, we're seeing that just the demand for NVIDIA, because they're the go-to option, has gone through the roof. And I think they're, you know, essentially making GPUs as fast as they can and selling them even faster.
The chip market in general, I didn't realize this until the last year or so, but how much of a concentration there is in terms of chip manufacturing. You know, chips power the world, right? Like they power the modern information and knowledge world. I feel like I'm almost certainly off a little bit here, but I feel like it's like Taiwan makes like 2/3 of all the chips, maybe 70%. The US makes 10%, but there's only two or three places where like 90% of the chips in the world come from. And I never realized it was such a wildly concentrated industry, and also like some of the shocks and potential dangers that could have for, you know, just shutting down supply lines for, anyway, it's such an interesting market in that regard. For NVIDIA, I was reading in one of your newsletters prepping up for this, and you mentioned about like the chips are getting built, like you have LLMs, right? And obviously you have companies like NVIDIA who are creating chips specifically for AI, but it almost sounded like that they are creating chips specifically to help with LLMs, or that they're optimizing chips to be able to have that chat experience, like with ChatGPT, work insanely fast, almost at a hardware level. Is that one of the reasons that, are they doing that? And are they doing that in a way? Is that one of the reasons why they're becoming so valuable?
I think the most recent demo we saw of like lightning fast LLM usage was actually not NVIDIA. It was a company called Grok. And Grok is a kind of an interesting story. They've been quietly under the radar building AI-specific chips for years. I think they were founded in 2016. One of the founders, he used to work at Google, and he worked at Google building TPUs, tensor processing units. And so he left Google, started this company. They've mostly been, I think, building essentially just like very niche chips for, like, I assume it's like finance or, you know, other like really high powered use cases that you don't hear much about publicly. But they've had a public demo up for a little while that essentially, yeah, can create LLM responses 10 times faster than, you know, going to Microsoft Azure and using their infrastructure, which I think is crazy, but it's also incredibly exciting, because I think it, you know, the newsletter issue where I was researching that, it begs the question, okay, what can you do now with this, right? What is unlocked that we haven't fully appreciated yet. I think with AI in general, but with every one of these 10x increases in capability, I kind of ask myself this question. You know, I read smarter people's opinions on this question, because I think we haven't, like, we've barely scratched the surface of what is actually possible. Even if we stopped all new AI R&D, right? And we just said, look, here's the set of capabilities that you get. I think it's going to take us 5 to 10 years to actually fully embrace and capitalize on what we can now do, just kind of like as a society.
Yeah. Talk a little bit, if you would, about context windows and token limits. I mean, one of the things, in my opinion, for my very basic applications of AI, the thing that I see the most use in our business is synthesizing information. You take a massive podcast transcript or a huge article and you boil it down, or it's synthesizing information into ways that is just takes time for humans, but it's very incredibly fast for machines. But the thing that has always been the biggest limiter for me is that context window in ChatGPT. And I think it's still, I'm a plus user, which I'm guessing most people listening are. And maybe they've bumped it up, but it seems like it's been 8,000 tokens for quite a while. You were talking about Gemini. You were talking about ChatGPT 4 Turbo, where you have context windows that are rapidly expanding and really opening up just massive new possibilities. Can you talk a little bit about that? Like, what's available now in terms of context windows, if you know, for laymen, for people that don't have, you know, an insight at Google or OpenAI? What are the context windows now? What are the ones that are coming down the pipe really soon? And like, what does that mean for the world of what we can do?
Yeah. So I think when talking about context windows, I guess let me back up and just explain that, right, in case folks aren't familiar. It's the idea that when you're interfacing with an LLM, you know, with a chatbot, this is a gross oversimplification, but for lack of a better term, there is a certain amount of short-term memory that the chatbot has. And it's why, you know, you can send a couple of messages to ChatGPT and it will remember the context of those messages. It will, you know, pick up on that stuff. It's why you can provide system instructions if you're a power user of ChatGPT, and it will remember those. But that short-term memory has a limit, right? And so if you just keep the same conversation with ChatGPT going over and over again, new messages, eventually it's going to forget the things that you told it at the beginning of the conversation, right? And that's mostly a limit of when these models are trained. There is kind of an upper bound on how much, you know, how many words you can throw at them in one go, right? And so we need to, like, that's kind of baked into, you know, the architecture of the model when it's trained. And so you need to, you know, reserve some for creating responses, but also, you know, ensure that you're not kind of overloading that input, right? And the, you know, the first version of GPT-4, actually, I think the first version of ChatGPT was only 1,000 or so tokens. This is another thing that's worth explaining. So a token is basically, it's 3/4 of a word, right? And the reason that we use tokens is just there's a lot of, like, technical reasons why it becomes a little bit more useful to use tokens instead of words. There are a lot of downsides to doing so, which I'm sure we'll you know, in the coming months and years, the ML community will work through. But essentially, you break a word or a sentence into these smaller chunks. They're about 3/4 of a word, and you feed them into the machine. And so the first version of ChatGPT only had about 1,000 tokens, which is like 750 words, right? I believe the like average amount of like words per page for like a book is about 500. So that's like a page and a half of, you know, of text. GPT-4, when it came out, had went up to 8,000, as you said, you know, which is a bit better. The latest models, so the benchmarks for the latest models, GPT-4 Turbo has about 100,000. Claude 2.1 has 200,000, and kind of this preview version of Gemini 1.5 has a 1 million token context window, although they have said in research environments they've gotten it to work up to 10 million tokens.
That's crazy.
That to me is one of the most exciting things that I've kind of heard, right? Because adding more, there's so much when you're building these applications. I think most business owners, you know, most e-commerce business owners here are probably just going to be familiar with a couple of consumer use cases, right? It's like, I want to chat with my PDFs, right? Or I want AI to maybe write some marketing copy. For maybe more nuanced or deeper applications, there's a lot of you know, jerry rigging that you have to do to kind of make LLMs work with these like very short context windows. And I think having, you know, a 10 million token context window kind of just enables a lot more things that, you know, you can just throw stuff in there, right? Like, you know, what does it mean when you can toss 10 textbooks into an LLM and it just knows everything that you know, to a pretty high degree, it knows everything that you've just thrown at it, right? Or with Gemini 1.5, it's also multimodal. So you can work with other mediums than text. You can throw in an hour long movie and it will like correctly answer questions about the content of that movie, right? That's crazy. I don't think we've actually like fully understood what it means to be able to do that and what you can do with that.
Well, I've always said that if I could have any superpower, it would be being able to never forget anything that I heard or read and be able to synthesize it and kind of like incorporate it into conversations and to life and to behavior and all those kind of things. And you're kind of getting a level of that when you get 10 million tokens. I mean, you could, ECF Live is coming up in a couple of weeks. We could take every single speech from ECF Live, put that in there and have it crank out, you know, amazing takeaways. In just, you could do that. You could record all of your company meetings or your team meetings and say like, hey, what recommendations would you have for how we could run these better? Or what are the problems that keep coming up? You could put that under your customer service support ticket to you have this just hyper, the applications with larger context windows, I think are one of the most exciting things with AI. And I can't wait until, you know, like I said, layman like myself can actually access those. Cause I think it'll be unbelievable.
Or even, you know, you can also kind of obviate some of the, you know, ECF members will know you guys tested a chatbot where you could, you know, search on like past ECF threads. And I am really curious about how many tokens the entire forum sizes, because there's a lot of technical stuff you have to do where you take this forum thread, you like anonymize it, you chunk it, you turn it into embeddings, you go do vector database search, right? Can you just throw the entire forum into like, can you get rid of all of those technical steps, right? And just throw the entire forum into a 10 million token context window.
That would be amazing. And thank you for, I think you helped out with some of the feedback on that. And for people listening, we spent probably 20, you know, tens of thousands of dollars to develop this custom application to try to take the forum, be able to use it with ChatGPT with some very strong privacy protections as well, given it's a kind of a closed forum. And we ended up scrapping it partially for a couple of reasons. One, because part of what you said, like there was a lot of horse and dance and like, that's the wrong phrase, but a lot of like extra work we had to do to get around that context window with separate databases and things. And I thought, you know, man, it takes a lot of money to maintain a custom app and a custom process. And in a year, is this all going to be just for naught and we can plug this in? The other thing too was like the results that we got were not that great. Like we were thinking about it partially from a user standpoint for our forum members, but also from an admin standpoint. So like, hey, can we use this as a way to be able to find the right people to connect and do these things? And we used it. And even after 3 or 4 months of development, tens of thousands of dollars, the results were not that great. But I think you're right. I think if you could just dump the entire forum in, or even, you know, even you take the top 20% of posts and dump those in, I think with all of that context there, without having to cherry pick things, would be much, much better. So hopefully that's coming down the pipe soon. And yeah, I can't wait. It's gonna be very cool. One thing that I think is fascinating is this, the whole idea of AI is fairly new to the scene. It's called a year and a half, at least in like a very mainstream way. And it's fascinating and so powerful now, but it relies, as everyone knows, on information from people, right? From writing and art and all these things to feed the engine. And you've got lawsuits out there now from different people, different groups, kind of alleging copyright infringement, which I think, in my opinion, have some merit. It was also interesting, like Reddit just struck a deal with Google, I think for like, you know, $60 million to license all of their information into the LLMs, because I think previously they've been blocking it. And anyway, what are your thoughts on like where things go from here in terms of the lawsuits, in terms of like what it means for information online? Like we're great now because we've got, I think in one of your newsletters, you even said like half of all news sites now are blocking open AI crawlers. So it's kind of crazy that we've had such an open web for such a long time, but the raw material, like the commodity of it, I think the informational commodity was taken for granted until now. And now I wonder if we're going to get into this world where people are starting to close up, where closed communities become more valuable, and we almost kind of revert in terms of informational availability. So I don't know, I threw a lot out there, but any thoughts on all that?
Sure. Yeah. I think to start with the scraping and the open web question, I do think we are headed away from an open web, right? Which kind of makes me sad. I think there's a lot of value in being able to find this stuff. I think even before AI, right, there was a big shift away from blogs, first to Reddit, right, but then now to Discord, right? And the amount of like knowledge and information that's locked up in private Discord servers, you know, the minute those wind down or the minute you leave that server, like you no longer have access to any of that, right? Which I think is a shame. There is a bigger question about, should that information be freely available for AI? And I think that's a really hard question, right? I guess like obligatory disclaimer, I'm not a lawyer. I'm certainly not an IP lawyer. I'm certainly not your IP lawyer. But, you know, I take that as, you know, these are half-baked legal opinions here. But I think it's a real open question around, in terms of copyright, I think there's so many gray area questions right now. So is it legal to scrape, you know, to crawl publicly available data for the purposes of training an AI model, right? The AI companies would obviously argue that's fair use, right? It is up there for the public. And, you know, if you can crawl it and use it for a search engine, or if you can crawl it and, you know, just have a copy of it because it's public, like, why is it any different to train an AI model on it, right? I think the counter argument is, you know, this is a use case that nobody envisioned, I mean, even 5 years ago, right? And so would people have made different decisions around making this public had they known the potential ramifications? There are open questions like, who owns copyright for a generated image? The answer is, we don't know. Or can an AI-generated image violate copyright? If you go into Midjourney and if you don't use the word, you know, Homer Simpson, but you tell it, I want a yellow-skinned man who's balding, you know, with a 5 o'clock shadow, wearing a white t-shirt and blue jeans, who's a cartoon, and what comes out looks exactly like Homer Simpson, is somebody liable for that, right? Or, you know, there's so many open questions right now around deepfakes. You know, I think that's probably going to be one of the big themes this year, at least in the US, like politically. What are we doing to regulate deepfakes? Mm-hmm. What should we be doing to regulate deepfakes, right? I think there are probably good free speech reasons why you cannot copyright a voice. And so I think like the very blunt response is, well, yeah, just make voices and faces copyrightable. I don't think that's actually probably the right solution, that we need something a little bit more nuanced than that.
Do you think we're going to have, I'm a betting man, I like to bet, and I would bet on the fact that we're going to have, as deepfakes, like Sona? I can't remember the OpenAI's text to video that got released.
Sora.
Thank you, Sora. I mean, the early images out of that look really compelling, almost movie-like in their realism. I saw a really funny picture, maybe it was even in your newsletter, of Donald Trump and Joe Biden hanging around in Hawaiian shirts around a hot tub, looking like they were just, you know, reminiscing about their golden college years together. You can just tell it's a deep fake from just the countenance on their faces. But we are going to see so much of that. And it seems like there has to be an industry that pops up where people can digitally sign, either in real time or on a photo or something, or a video, endorse that this is me. You know, so like Joe Biden gets on there, Donald Trump gets on there, they can somehow indice, kind of like with one-way, I don't know if it works with one-way cryptography or how it works, but some kind of way, there's got to be a whole industry that pops up to validate voices and podcasts and images and videos. Otherwise, you're not going to know. So I don't know. It seems like that's an inevitability in where we're going.
Andrew, are you describing an NFT right now?
Yes, 100%. And this is why when people were pooping all over NFTs, the one thing I thought, and I've said this on the podcast in the past, was like, yes, for 90% of the cases that people are talking about, they're useless, but this would be amazing for authenticating who you are digitally.
I think it would be there probably will be something like that. I mean, I don't know that we'll get as far as NFTs, although there's an argument that like I have made in my head that I think AI and like crypto happened in the wrong order. But like had we had generative AI and then NFTs, I think people would have responded far more positively to them instead of the other way around. But I do think there will be things, not necessarily technological solutions. I think most of the solutions are probably going to be, well, there will be some regulatory, right? And so like there is a technical solution in the sense of like the government says you must watermark every video coming out of this, you know, piece of technology, right? But I think there are probably just a lot of like political and societal solutions where one thing that is not going to shock me is companies that pledge to use like, you know, human generated content, right? Like, and that is a badge that you can like have, you know, maybe that even goes as far as becoming like a type of certification that you can get from a body somewhere, you know, but in the way that food is like, you know, GMO free, right? You can, you know, you will probably find companies that proudly bear, we are like an AI free, you know, content company.
Yeah. I can see companies like Patagonia, B Corps, like very much getting, you know, a similar type of endorsement or kind of vibe for that. What can you give us a sense? I'm very familiar with with ChatGPT. I think a lot of people are. Gemini is newer on the scene. That's Google AI's platform. And notwithstanding all kind of the kind of craziness that came out the last couple of days with, you know, how search results are coming up with images and people, let's leave that aside. But just from a functionality standpoint, how does Gemini compare to ChatGPT? Like, I'm sure you've played with both of them. Does one seem materially better than the other? Thoughts on the two platforms?
The newest version of Gemini, I've played with a little bit, and it's pretty good. I don't know that I would call it materially better than ChatGPT. Oh, and by the way, just for folks who may not know this, there are like multiple versions of all of these chatbots, right? I think that I encounter a lot of folks who don't realize that there are, for example, two versions of ChatGPT, right? There's the free version running internally GPT-3, and there is a paid version running GPT-4. And if you have ever had an experience with ChatGPT and walked away saying that was not that impressive, I don't know what the big deal is, consider going back and trying the paid version, right? Because to me, it is night and day different in terms of how good its responses are. So when I'm talking about these things, I'm you know almost always referring to the latest, often paid versions. And I think with Gemini, that's also going to be the case. They're going to put their latest models behind a paid version that you can upgrade and pay Google for. But I think the model itself, you know, in my limited testing, it's pretty close to GPT-4. I've seen a lot of anecdotal evidence from folks that I think there are certain tasks where they really prefer Google's AI, right? Usually it's some niche, like, you know, I use it to write backstories for like my fiction projects, or I use it to write code, you know, for my side hobbies. And I think in those cases, there may be a specific use case that is better. But I think that actually touches on kind of a really important point, which is this stuff changes so fast, right? And even if it didn't change that fast, so Wharton professor Ethan Mollick, he has also a really great AI newsletter called One Useful Thing, but he's talked about this concept of the jagged frontier, right? And it's this idea that if you think about like, what are the limits of a piece of technology, right? Often it's pretty clear like what it is good at and like what it is not, right? But with AI, we have this kind of zigzaggy line of like things that you think would be categorically the same are wildly different in terms of how it does, right? So ChatGPT can generate like incredible poetry, incredible essays. If you ask it to output exactly 42 words, it can't do it. Right. Or it might do it, but it will get lucky essentially. Right. You know, if you ask it to do kind of like basic math problems, right, it will, again, some of them it can do, but there are others where it just kind of fails spectacularly. Right. Or things like, what was the one? There's like very basic reasoning. You know, we could debate the definition of reasoning all day, but there are some very basic reasoning capabilities in these LLMs. And yet, if you go ask Gemini, maybe they fixed this by now, but what is heavier, like 2 pounds, like 2 pounds of feathers or a pound of bricks, right? It's going to say, oh, they're the same weight, right? Because it's been trained on the you know, classic gotcha question, right? And so you have to play with these things. You have to experiment for yourself because it's you know, it's so nuanced and subtle where it's good and where it's not. And then even then on top of that, right, every 3 to 6 months, there is a new breakthrough, there is a model update, right? And so the things that you may have taken for granted as it being good at or not being good at are different now, right? The canonical example recently has been over the winter, ChatGPT suddenly got quote unquote lazier, right? And nobody really understood why. OpenAI, you know, said, we haven't changed anything about the model. We don't understand why this is happening. But there was quite a lot, and I experienced this myself personally, there was quite a lot of anecdotal evidence that it would, for example, if you told it to, so one thing that I use for a lot of my side projects, I'll use ChatGPT to help me write code. I noticed it would start, you know, where it previously would have just written the entire block of code out, it now would write the first few lines and then it would say dot, 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 fill in the rest here. And then it would like write the end of it. And as a user, it's very weird, right? You're like, why did you stop? Like, no, go finish it. And you have to tell it again, you know, go back and write the whole thing out and it'll do it at that point. But it was just very weird that it started doing this and nobody had a good answer. I don't know that OpenAI, not that I, to my knowledge, I don't think OpenAI ever explained it. They said we fixed it, but I don't know if they explained why it was happening. One guess that I really loved was that they were injecting in the system prompt the current date, right? And as it got closer to Thanksgiving and Christmas, based on all of the data it was trained on, it had learned, it's time for the holidays. I need to just slack off and do less work. And the fact that that is an actual like plausible theory is a little bit insane, right? Like that is kind of, you know,
concerning to it because it implies that there's like, that there's an incentive for it to want to do that, which implies it maybe has some kind of like some level of cognition or humanity is the wrong word, but sentientness, if that's sort of, at least that's what I think about it.
Well, you can incentivize it. Again, anecdotal evidence, but folks are going out there and saying, look, if you answer this, I'm going to give you $20. And like, it will statistically produce longer answers when you do that, right? Not necessarily that's better, crazy. But longer.
That's crazy. I have a 1 to 5% understanding of how they train LLMs. And so kind of getting into dangerous territory here, but is it, I've heard that, you know, a lot of times the engineers that train these and that create these models, they create the framework, they feed a bunch of data into it. And you're creating these kind of, you know, kind of virtual neural networks on a machine level. And they kind of understand how it works. But if I'm, let's say I'm at 2%. And the people who are doing this cutting edge, maybe they're at 60 or 70%. But between 60 and 100%, they're still not like exactly sure what's going on in the black box. Like they create it, they feed it the information comes out and they can fine tune the inputs and the outputs. But what's happening on the inside, they're not exactly sure. Is that a fair summarization? Like, is that a fair characterization of, is that true? Or is that kind of a urban myth that I have heard about AI?
I don't know that I would say they don't understand what's going on because it all boils down to math. Right. I think the thing that is very difficult is one, it turns out there are emergent properties that come out of just scaling these things up. So for example, you know, we like this was kind of OpenAI's big bet as a company, right? But that if you took the transformer architecture that Google invented and then, you know, you just throw more scale at it, you give it more data, you give it more GPUs, you make the neural networks bigger. As it turns out, there's like kind of some reasoning ability that comes out of that, right? To make a gross oversimplification, ChatGPT it's autocomplete on steroids, right? The underlying architecture is designed to, given a set of words, just predict what is the most likely next word to come out, right? But it turns out that when you do that at a large enough scale, it starts to resemble, you know, cognition. Right. And so I think it's very difficult to reason about, okay, if we keep going, what does that look like and where, you know, what comes out of that? Right. I think the other difficulty is that, you know, again, since it's autocomplete, these are probabilistic models, right? So there is a set of probabilities for the potential next word to come out of the machine. And so, you know, you can pick that probability, but it's very difficult to know exactly kind of where that's going to end up, right? And so you can run the same thing over and over again, and you might wind up in some cases with like great output, in other cases in terrible output, but it may just be a matter of like it picked a slightly different probability this time.
Hey, Andrew here with a quick sidebar. I want to introduce you to Julia from abarabove.com. where she and her husband and co-founder sell premium mixology products. Julie's been incredible. She's one of our meetup leaders in California and just an amazing human. And here's what she has to say about her experience with the e-commerce fuel private community for 7 and 8 figure owners.
Anytime I hire an agency or use software, I always search ECF first, not just for the specific software that I'm considering, but also on a broader sense. Like, does anybody have recommendations? You know, what are you using for this? And on a large number of occasions, the ECF community has mentioned other alternatives that I may not have known about or considered. And as a result, a lot of times I've used those choices. And even better than that, sometimes I even got a discount. So I would say that's definitely the thing I most frequently use about ECF and also probably has provided the most direct benefit.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7 or 8 figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show. We're about 39 minutes into the discussion, and I haven't talked. We've been highly theoretical on a lot of different things, at least in terms of the applications for business, but which has been super entertaining, and 100% my fault because I've been guiding us down that road. I'd love to get your thoughts on how you're, on the flip side, using this in your business. So you have probably a vantage point on AI that is more comprehensive than almost anyone listening. What are the tools as an e-commerce store owner that you are using on a daily, weekly basis? That, because there's a lot of hype out there, there's a lot of tools that just don't live up to the marketing. But what are the ones that you either the processes you're using with ChatGPT or tools, or how are you using this in your own business to make more money or save time?
It's actually kind of a funny question. We don't use that much AI. A lot of this,
not a good sign.
I think it's very important. I think there are a lot of good use cases. I'll preface that by saying we're a little bit of a weird e-commerce company. I think we're kind of I like to say we're a zebra in a room full of horses, in that we have the same shape of a lot of e-com companies, but often because of the nature of our business, that the challenges that we run into are slightly different. There are some things that we've dabbled around. You know, So we do a lot of custom merchandise for influencers, right? And so that is like not every client uses every service, but that can be graphic design help. That can be, you know, getting R&D done out of China and importing it. That can be, you know, setting up their online store. We do fulfillment. We do printing. We do, you know, customer service, all of that stuff. And so we've dabbled, I think, at the edges, right? Like we've had some tools when it comes to helping write product descriptions, right? I think Shopify itself, which we use as our front end, bakes a lot of really great AI stuff kind of natively into their platform. You know, we're using, for our team, we're using ChatGPT to help, you know, not just like blindly write and send copy, but, you know, can we edit this better? Or can we take a first draft at this that, like, you know, we can edit so that we're not staring at the blank page for hours? I've poked around a little bit with AI image generation, right? I think when it comes to graphic design, right? Can we be more efficient by just getting these first rough drafts done by an AI, which the influencer can give us feedback on or can say, I like that style. And then they can, you know, we can hand that off to a designer to professionalize it, right? Because I think, you know, the big challenge with a lot of these AI tools is that they get like 60% of the way there, and you still have to figure out how to cross that 40%, right? So like for the graphic design example, Midjourney will create some incredible looking output. You cannot put 99% of that on a t-shirt, right? For a few reasons. I mean, they've worked on the actual resolution of the images. So now they're getting close to like high enough resolution to print. But even beyond that, a lot of them have, you know, they'll have like, if you're a screen printer, they'll have gradients, which are a nightmare to work with. There's like weird edges. There's like splashes of color and weird edges and stuff, right? That like, unless you're printing a rectangular block of an image on a t-shirt, like most people don't want that. And so you still have to get a human involved to get to the finish line. And I think same thing with there are a lot of AI companies trying to do mock-ups, right? Like, you know, show us images of your product and we'll just like create mock-ups for you, right? And I think they get most of the way there, but most of the business owners I know care like far more about the final like look and feel of stuff, right? And so they're not going to be inclined to just like, good enough, like let's put it up, right? I think there's probably some use case for that, but my guess is your average ECF member is going to say like, I don't know that I trust the final quality of this thing just yet.
Yeah, that makes total sense. That's been my experience as well. What are the coding projects that you're, are those related to CrowdMade or like something else? What are you coding up these days?
There's a lot of coding related to CrowdMade. So we, one of the like parts of our, you know, of our secret sauce is we've scaled very well. Like we are an exceptionally lean team. A lot of that is possible based on software that we've built, right? That, you know, I've built internally. And then just for fun, you know, just to keep fresh, I code up stuff. One, we didn't talk about this much, but I think one of the beautiful things about AI is that it allows you to readjust like the ambition of things you thought you could do, right? The best outcomes from AI are not AI replaces humans, it's AI augments humans. And so, for example, a few months ago, I wrote a Chrome extension for myself in a weekend. I wanted to like do some stuff in my Gmail, right? To like customize some of the things that were happening there. And previously, I knew that I could. I knew it was technically possible, but I just was like, look, it's going to take 3 weeks of like bashing my head into the, you know, Chrome extension documentation. I don't want to do this. It's not worth it. With ChatGPT, I could spit and GitHub Copilot, I could spit something out in a day or two. And this is like a project I never would have attempted, right? Because I was like, there's no way it's gonna end well, or I'm not even gonna finish it. But now I can.
What are some of, and again, with respecting that you've got some secret sauce you don't necessarily want to reveal, what are some of the areas and the high level areas that you're using coding and automation to create a really streamlined team for a merch business like that you have? Because I think a lot of people think, oh, hey, I'm not a SaaS business. There's only so much I can automate here. But it seems like you're doing that really well. What are some of those areas?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is the operation, right? So while we do a lot of in-house printing, we don't print everything, right? You know, we do a lot of apparel and we do fulfillment, but we don't print the mugs or the phone cases, right? The things where it's like you need special equipment to do each and every model. So we have this like, you know, system where a product comes in, you know, we can marshal it to the correct partner who's going to print it and then, you know, automatically go get the tracking back and update it. There's a lot of things too around just like keeping track of everything, right? So I mentioned that we use Shopify as our front end, but within Shopify, there's no way to keep track of which influencer is this product for, right? I guess now with Metafields, you can do some of this, but when we first started, right, there was no way to keep track of which influencer is tied to this product, what is the cost of this product that they're going to be, you know, making additional profit on, what, it's just a t-shirt, like, is it a Gildan t-shirt, is it American Apparel, what is the design, where does the artwork live, how big is the artwork, where's the placement, all of these kind of like downstream just pieces of metadata, we had to build our own custom backend in order to store all that, and then we kind of bundle it all together and then put it into Shopify.
Mm, interesting. Okay. So really, it sounds like fulfillment is a huge part where you do a lot of coding to keep track of things, to smooth things out.
Yeah. Yeah. The logistics side is kind of where, you know, we were able to scale. A lot of the like headcount, human headcount, right, comes from doing like sales and account management, right? More than operations.
Yeah. That's very cool. And are you writing all this all in Ruby, or what are you writing this all in?
Python.
Python. Okay. Got it. Talk about CrowdMade a little bit. So crowdmade.com. So you do custom merch and apparel for influencers. So is this, dive into that business model a little bit and lay it out for people.
Yeah, we got started, I think 9 years ago now, before the term creator economy existed. I remember when we first got started, it was functionally impossible to explain my job to anybody over the age of 30.
I think a lot of people can relate to this. Maybe not in the creator world, but just in different phases of trying to explain random e-commerce businesses. So I think you get a lot of people laughing right now, myself included.
The concept that one, an influencer could be a business, right? And two, you could build a business supporting that business, right? Was just so foreign that, you know, I think we basically, like, I don't think my dad still understands what I do to this day, but, you know, we'll...
He's like, I think there's an 80% chance Charlie is just selling drugs and this is his cover story, but...
Yeah,
but we'll like, go with this whole influencer thing. And
he's
this
like,
whole,
he does something, but I don't really. It's on the internet, you know. That's what he puts radio on the internet, you know. And And so, yeah, YouTube is our bread and butter, although we've kind of, you know, we've got our fingers in like Instagram and TikTok and Twitch. And if you are an influencer with a very large audience, often you want to monetize, right? And the first way to do that is through ads. So just like, you know, turn on ads for your channel. The second way to do that is through sponsorships or I think direct fan, you know, contributions. So you're negotiating a deal with HelloFresh or Audible or, you know, Raycon, and, you know, you'll get their, like, they'll give you the copy and you'll read it at the beginning end of the video, right? And you'll get paid for that. Or fans can just directly, you know, sponsor you, like give you a $5, $10 a month to help produce content. And then the third way is merchandise, right? And so it turns out that it's really easy to do merch poorly, which I think we kind of learned through trial and error. But we have built kind of a wide range of services. Again, as long as the unit economics make sense, we can kind of do almost anything for a creator, right? So if we need to go and, you know, source a project out of China, we can do that, but it comes with minimum order quantities and things like that. You know, again, this is getting back to what I alluded to in terms of like your stereotypical e-commerce business. They're going to say, cool, here's this product. We're going to sell it. It's going to do well. We're going to sell more, right? And we're going to like leverage economies of scale. We never get to do that, right? Every single project is different one after the other, right? And so we have to figure out how do we take these capabilities that normally like really huge businesses are doing and figure out how do we offer them in like tiny, tiny scales to more YouTubers.
So is this, for example, if I start a YouTube channel playing NBA Jam, because that was, you know, one of the best, you know, best games of all time, build up a Twitch following, people are watching it, I get a big following, and I want to offer jerseys and hats and all this stuff, but I don't want to deal with the sourcing, I don't want to deal with the website. I call Charlie and you take care of all of like the sourcing, the buying, the selling it, and pretty much I can slap this up on my website and get paid for it. You guys get a cut. And is that kind of how it works?
It's the one thing I would take issue with is the notion of a cut. So the way that the business model works is we figure out what is all of our overhead, what is all of our cost, and we bake that into a price. And then you are free to sell it on your store for any dollar amount above that, right? And you will keep 100% of the profit above that, right? So in that jersey example, we may come to you and say, look, it's going to be like $15 to make this jersey, right? Like that is our cost to you. And then if you want to go and, you know, sell it for $30, for $50, for $100, like more power to you, right? It just depends on the strength of your brand.
Is that all outbound marketing? Because I imagine like the inbound for trying to get people, I mean, you build a reputation over time and I'm sure that builds up a little bit, but you've got to be approaching those influencers to pitch them as becoming clients. How do you do lead gen and like customer acquisition for something like that?
You are correct. I don't know how much of this I want to talk about publicly. We do a lot of outbound sales, I think is the short answer. And to your point, you're spot on. At this point, we have developed enough of a reputation that we get some decent inbound. When we first started, it was a lot of relationship building, right? I think the thing that struck me, or the thing I've learned about the creator economy, is that it is a relationships business more than anything else. And especially like social proof, right? Being able to say, we work with X, right? Goes a huge way in getting more clients on board. But yeah, we have a whole system for doing outbound marketing.
Interesting. What are your thoughts on the creator kind of influencer market and world right now? You know, it's I don't want to say it's mature, but it's definitely not nascent like it was 3 or 4 years ago, even five years ago. What are you seeing in terms of trends, in terms of creators, in terms of platforms? That's a big kind of blank canvas to give you there. But what are you seeing out there?
I think there's a lot of change, but there's always a lot of change, right? I think one of the pros and cons of this industry is that it's so volatile. Your clients who are your top tier ones today, or if you're an e-commerce business doing influencer marketing, right? Your best influencer marketers today are probably not going to be your best ones in a year or two, because, you know, either they get bigger and they get more expensive and out of your budget, or they fade into obscurity, right? And some new person comes along. So it's this constant kind of like staying on top of who's new, who's up and coming. The industry in like the venture-backed startup space took a big hit over the last couple of years, right? I think like the bottom kind of fell out of Well, like venture funding in general, but before that, creator economy funding. I think there was a realization of like, it's actually fairly difficult to convert big audiences into like high conversion rates. It's not impossible. Like our business exists because it is possible, right? Like if all influencer marketing was a scam, we wouldn't have a company, right? So I do believe there's some value there. I think it's just very difficult to navigate doing the influencer marketing without just a lot of trial and error.
Yeah, I have been thinking a lot more about longevity recently in careers, in terms of business, in terms of anything, right? The longer you're in a game, the more compounding you can have, the more skills you build. Like it's such a huge asset to have. And so something I've been thinking a lot more about and studying more. You've been doing this for 9 years, seen a lot of influencers come and go. And a hard question to ask, given you're not an LLM, you know, with a $10 million context window, they can analyze all these data points. But are there any of those influencers that you can think of that you've worked with that have been around for all 9 years or most of that 9 years, and they've stuck with it, and maybe they haven't blown up to be Mr. Beast, but they still have a meaningful audience 7, 8 years later? Anything stick out to you that they do well, that they focus on? What's the, and I think what I'm trying to do is steal some lessons for all of us as entrepreneurs. Like, what do you see, especially in the media world and the online attention world we live in today? What are they doing well that allows them to give them some longevity in the space?
There's one that immediately comes to mind, Jax Films. He was doing YouTube for years, long before we ever worked with him. I think he's been doing it for, I'm going to mess this up, but it's in the ballpark of like 15 years now. And his content, he's actually, the last few years, he's grown a decent amount, right? I wouldn't say he's necessarily like a household name like Mr. Beast or, you know, or Linus Tech Tips, but he's grown a reasonable amount. And I think it's the formula is kind of put something out there, right? Put it out there consistently, do that for a long time. And then for some people, it's a short time, right? Sometimes you get lucky. But I think over time, make it a little bit better each time, right? And experiment, right? Because every influencer who makes it big eventually finds something that really resonates with, you know, their existing audience or an audience that they're catering to. And when they see that working, they're able to kind of double down on it, right? And it is why you get these like YouTube channels where sometimes it goes in very weird directions, right? It's why you get these YouTube channels where it's like, I'm going to like take a bath in soy sauce today, right? Like, and that's, you know, but you watch them and they've got like 10 million views on the video, right? And it's like, okay, I understand how the incentives have led you here, right? But it's kind of a weird place to be in. And so I think, yeah, it's really just about just showing up consistently, right? And like having that little bit of agency on top. I don't think it takes that much, but having a little bit of agency on top to ask yourself, how do I get better? Or like, what is something I can try and see if it works with my audience?
Getting a little short on time here, but I want to, again, give a mention to artificial ignorance. Ignorance.ai is the URL if you want to check it out. And I've been subscribed before we scheduled this podcast, but as prep for it, went in and read a handful of your recent editions, and just really good work, man. Like, they're comprehensive, they're interesting. You kind of have a good smattering of top stories that you kind of give some good takeaways for, and then a very broad brush that you paint with like all of the little things that people can dive into if they want to. It's nicely done. So if you would give people just a sense of what they can expect to get from the newsletter, apart from what I just said, and anything else I missed, but you're doing really good work there, man. It takes a ton of time to put something like that together, and it shows that you love it.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, it's a currently twice a week newsletter. So Fridays are news roundups, right? We'll cover three, you know, meant to be read in like 5 minutes or less. We'll cover three themes from the week with a ton of links, like you mentioned, to dive deeper. And then Wednesdays are kind of a mixed bag. It's some long form content, but it's really a variety show. In terms of, some days I'll write kind of essays, like the high level theoretical stuff we've been talking about. Some days I'll do a tutorial and like, here's how you fine tune ChatGPT for yourself, right? For your use case. Sometimes it's a interview, you know, with somebody who's working on cool stuff. You know, sometimes it's none of that. And I'm just kind of like throwing ideas at the wall and see, and I'm doing that experimentation, right? That we just talked about, just to see what resonates.
How many let's skip the reading that you have to do to stay up on all that stuff. How long does it take you to put together every newsletter? Is it like, I would guess it'd be in the three plus hour range, if not longer.
Yeah, and for sure. I think the news ones, the Friday ones, are getting a little bit faster. I can usually knock those out in like 2.5-3 hours. The deep dives, it's usually in the ballpark of like 10 plus hours, if you include, wow, like especially the research and everything.
That's crazy. What shows? So if you're interested in this, if you've made it this long in an AI related podcast talking about all sorts of very high level things, check it out, ignorance.ai. I can't recommend it enough. Charlie, let's end, if you're up for it, with a lightning round. So I'm going to give you, you know, about, I don't know, 10 questions here. Feel free to answer them, just the word or two or three sentences. But how would you describe the AI environment right now?
Agony and ecstasy. I think there's, you know, a lot to, so much to keep up with. It's so exciting. There's a lot of hype, but I wouldn't dismiss it or bet against it long term.
What's one of the fondest memories from your childhood?
I'd probably say my mom had a really big family. She's one of 7 kids. And I think almost all of them lived in the same city. So in the summers, we would go out and do like these massive cookouts and just spending time with all my aunts and uncles and cousins.
Oh, very cool. That's awesome. You're a big scuba diver. I've done a lot of scuba diving in the past, a little less recently with the arrival of your 18-month-old daughter. But where is the best place you've ever scuba dived?
Toss up between, as a recurring destination, the island of Bonaire in the Caribbean. I think as a one-off, the SS Yongala, which was a shipwreck off the coast of Australia. Unreal diving experience. Got like nothing I've ever done before.
Wow. Just because of the wildlife or because of you actually went in the ship and like were poking around?
I went a little bit in the ship. It's very dangerous to go inside a shipwreck without proper training. But it's the only structure on the ocean floor for miles. So it's become this kind of de facto reef where every, you know, piece of marine wildlife stops by, right? And so it's just like a density of fish and everything that I've never encountered before.
Very cool. I believe you live in Berkeley right now. If you weren't living there, where would you live?
Probably London.
And why London?
My wife is she's half Irish, but she's got family and you know, kind of a home base in London.
What's the hardest part of writing a newsletter?
Coming up with a new thesis every Wednesday to try and, you know, research and prove out to people.
That sounds brutal. Sounds really brutal. How much money in the bank is enough? So you can either answer this one as, hey, if I had 10 million in the bank, that'd be plenty for life. If I had 500,000 a year in annuity, like income coming in, that would be plenty. However way you want to skin it, how much is enough?
I don't know if I have a number. I think it'd be enough that I didn't feel like I would need to work anymore. So I'd probably sit down and do the math on like, what is that actual number based on my expenses? But yeah, I would still work, right? Like, I think I would go a little insane, but to be able to, enough to not have to work for money, I think is the short answer.
Would that be, and I, a lot of people give me that answer and I always, as a rule, push back a little bit. What would that be? Would it be less than 10 million, more than 10 million? I always have to push back at least once to try to get an actual number from people.
So I think 10 million is probably a nice sounding round number. I think who says this? Ramit Sethi from I Will Teach You to Be Rich. He says like the way you feel about money is highly uncorrelated with how much is in your bank account, right?
Yes.
So I can give you a number. I think the number is a reflection of my psychology, right? Like not necessarily a practical, but my guess would be probably somewhere between 5 and 10 million.
Got it. Yeah, money is so interesting. I've heard him say that, and I think it's so true. Like I see that myself. I see that in people I know really well. It's so much of it is about how you grew up, like the mindset that you had when you grew up, or that you were given by your caretakers or your parents. Like, yes, Ramit said it about as well as you could. So, should do an episode about that at some point. How many hours a week do you work?
Do I include the newsletter in this?
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. Probably 50.
Do you have a favorite charity or cause?
I don't actually. I think for whatever reason, you know, I blame it on, I guess, being like children of immigrants. My parents were never that big into charity or philanthropy. And so it was not, I didn't have like an example set for me of like what that means to do that. Probably NPR is the thing that I give the most money to. That's a nonprofit.
Nice. Most impressive AI tool that you use. Let's put ChatGPT and Gemini aside, but apart from the big popular LLMs, what's the tool that you are using the most, do you think is the most impressive?
The one that I use the most is actually GitHub Copilot, outside of those. I think the one that I think is most impressive, I still continue to be amazed with 11 Labs and the quality of their voice output, the realism of it. I was tinkering around with some stuff. I'll send you after this, but you can kind of give it a listen and hear what's possible.
Is it? I used it a year ago to prank my friend Steve Chu at our conference and like pretty much make him say this awful, very humiliating apology in front of a bunch of people. And it was pretty, I'd say it was 90% there. Like if you listened, you could tell it wasn't quite him, but it was pretty good. Like the inflections were pretty good. A year forward, is it to the point where you can distinguish, like, is it indistinguishable from regular people? Like, is it that good at this point?
They're ones that you generate from within the system randomly, are pretty indistinguishable from real people. Their voice cloning has gotten better, but it really still does depend on, I think, the quality of the sample, right? So, for somebody like yourself who has a lot of hours of high quality audio floating around there on the internet, it probably wouldn't be that hard to create a very realistic Andrew clone. I don't know about your friend Steve, but I think if you could get, like a few minutes of him, like really crisp, high quality audio, you could make something pretty crazy.
Okay, great. That's good news. Although Steve may be hearing this too and have some ideas. Last question. Who's one of the more interesting people you've met through e-commerce fuel? And this could be someone you've met, talked to, or it could just be someone that you see them posting on the forums and you really appreciate what they offer.
I've had a few conversations with Katrina McKinnon, specifically around AI. I think her perspective's really been fascinating just as somebody who's in copywriting, right? Which everyone has sort of hailed as like a dying industry now that AI has come around. But I think she's got some really smart takes on how to thrive even in the face of that.
Yeah, Katrina's fantastic. Well, Charlie, thank you so much. Again, make sure you sign up for his newsletter, ignorance.ai. It's fantastic. If you happen to have a massive following out there and are looking for some swag and some merch to sell, he's also your man, crowdmade.com.
I would also say we are slowly starting to expand into like corporate and organizational apparel. So if you've got a pressing need for company swag, hit me up and we can figure something out.
Well, Charlie, this has been super fun. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for geeking out, letting me interrogate you for over, an hour and 15 minutes here. Really enjoyed it and looking forward to the rest of your newsletters. And I appreciate you being part of ECF too. You've been fantastic and it's great having you in there. So thank you for coming on and being willing to chat. This has been a blast.
Likewise. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. This has been a ton of fun. Looking forward I don't know enough ECF members. So like really looking forward to meeting more folks.
Yeah. You're going to be in New Orleans in a week and a half, right?
I'm not, but I would like to maybe the next ECF Live get out there.
Yeah, we'll see you at something in the future. I thought I saw your name on that for some reason. But yeah, we'll see you at the ground at some point. And yeah, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks a ton, man.
Thanks.
That's going to do it for this week. A big thank you to OneClick Upsell, who offers incredible upsell software to get more from every single customer and increase your average order value on your site. To make more money from the customers you already have, check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And if you own a 7 or 8 figure store, you really should be a part of our private community and forums here at eCommerce Fuel, where you can connect with over 1,200 store owners just like you. We're so confident it'll be a game changer that we offer a 10x ROI guarantee. If you don't see 10x your membership value in the first year, we'll refund you 100% of your membership fees plus toss in an extra $1,000 for the hassle. So you can learn more and apply at ecommercefuel.com. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard, adventure often, and look forward to seeing you again next Friday.